This is CliffCentral.com.
Trish Jenkins has a fascinating story. She went from growing a massive portfolio and managing huge amounts of money in an investment business to losing it all, and losing it all in a very dramatic sense. You know, my sister was telling me, Trish, she watched that movie about Bernie Madoff the other day.
Oh, right.
And she said it was fascinating. Robert De Niro plays Madoff, and it's, and she said she felt really sorry for him because she said he didn't seem like a bad guy, and he explained the way he was conducting business. In the beginning, he was very careful and fastidious and made sure that he dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's, and he was doing well. And then his clients got greedy, and he got greedy, and then things just kind of got out of control. And this is the biggest Ponzi scheme in history.
It is. It is. He's currently serving 150 years.
God.
That's America for you.
Well, you went to prison. I mean, you went in not for 150 years, thank goodness. Mm. If you did, you look really great for 150. But
yes.
What a story. I mean, your story is just as fascinating, and it's by no means any less terrifying. It must have been for you, I mean, to be in the middle of this, to know when you knew it at some point that you were in trouble.
Oh, it was like quicksand. And and the funny thing, you know, we demonize people. We think of in terms of us and them.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't realize, and you do have people who are just straight out predators, you do. But really, I've learned that there's a sliding scale, you know, and that given the right set of circumstances and the right pressures and fears and stresses, that anybody can compromise if they're not careful. And one of the things I do now is I warn business people how to protect themselves and be careful, even of themselves and their own vulnerabilities.
So let's just go back to the beginning. What kind of a life did you have before any of this drama happened? Who were you? What kind of family situation did you have? What was the business like? Was it fairly carefree? Were you doing well? You should have been happy.
Yes, well, my husband and I started out with nothing, and we got into real estate, and we would buy a house and pretty it up, get the, you know, get it revalued, get the equity, and do the next one. And that worked well for us, and we were up to about six houses. And,
wow.
But there's not a lot of cash flow in property, so we were looking at diversifying into other things, learning how to trade and so on. And I wasn't very good at trading, but I knew some people were. And I was introduced to a fellow who was a currency trader, and we invested with him, and that went very well. And then he asked me to be a contact person for his investors, and he also got a license with the Australian Securities Investments Commission. So I thought, well, if he's got a license, if they would have checked him out, he must be okay. And
what do you think he spotted in you?
I think he spotted my personality and that I'm good with people, I enjoy people, and I'm a natural, you know, if I believe in something, if I think it's great, my background is sales. And I'm enthusiastic. If something, you know, if I find a lipstick that's a great brand, I'll tell my friends.
Mm.
So, you know, he read me like a book, and he played me like a violin.
Well, perhaps he also just saw someone with a real talent. And maybe he saw a way to make that talent work for him, but that's something innate, something you have. So if he didn't find it, someone else might have.
Quite right. And I was fairly unconscious then of those qualities that I had. I was just interested in making money. And if that can help other people, then that's a great thing too, which is really quite naive. So my family situation was...
Why do you say it's naive?
Because from now on, you're on your own. You make your own money. I'm not going to recommend anything. You know? Yeah, you take your own risks.
Right.
But... you know, my husband, he's a great guy. He's very stable, and which is why we're still together, more so because of him than me. And we have three little girls, and we had a normal kind of a life. Well, normal in the sense that we did get to the point where we didn't have to have actual proper jobs anymore. But we're also part of a local church, and our philanthropy was important to us. So when we were doing really well, there were eight different charities and ministries that we were helping to support. That was our dream.
To me, this is sort of a textbook. You were almost like the perfect family. on paper, and people would have thought, well, they're doing so much for charity, they're making money, so they must be terribly clever. They've got these three girls. They seem to be happily married. It just looks so idyllic.
Look, it does. And you know, Gareth, the one thing about making money is it makes you think you're cleverer than what you really are. I don't care how much money you've got. You can get tripped up by things, and you've got to have the humility to pull your head in. That's an Australian term, and not get away with yourself. And you know, we did think that this was something that was worthwhile. And what I've learned since about con artists is that they do mirror you. They tailor the conversation. They listen to what you say. They get a hold of your values, and they mirror them back to you in conversation so that you think they're one of us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he never said he was a Christian, but he did say he was spiritual and he'd had a Catholic upbringing, and he agreed with the virtues and had those same values and so on. And he would talk about great things that he'd done to help people and so on. So he mirrored that to me, whereas to someone else he'd probably mirror, I don't know, parties and womanizing and that sort of thing. I don't know. I hadn't heard him say that. I did find out later on that he was he claimed to be a gambling addict. I didn't find that out until I was in his courtroom when he was getting sentenced, because I did actually help put him away afterwards.
Wow.
But, you know, nothing's ideal, but you do the best you can and you make the decisions you can. And I come from a, you know, I've got a pretty nice family, and my parents are pastors, which makes it even more embarrassing.
Pastor and prisoner, at least start with a P.
it was just crazy, and it was particularly humiliating and mentally damaging, because really I fell off my own pedestal and I didn't realize I had put myself on one.
You know, more than the story, which is fascinating, people can read your books, you've written three of them. More than your story, I want to know about how you felt in all of these different scenarios. At that point, you say, you know, people start to think that they're cleverer than they are. But do you also feel more virtuous? You're giving to all these charities. You're living this incredible life of abundance at that point. I assume there were millions in the bank. Are you feeling successful? Are you feeling prosperous? You know, how does it feel at that stage?
How does it feel? Look, it feels pretty normal. I mean, our wealth was tied up in our assets. Mm. So, and I mean, for a long time, our tenants lived better than we did, because we practiced delayed gratification, which is how you get wealthy. You don't go blowing it all and showing it off. We were never show-offs. But, you know, when you do things for other people because you can, it does make you feel good. You know, to spend it all on yourself is pretty empty. I mean, I've got nothing against having nice things. And we had started to turn the corner where we could afford to do some great things, but we hadn't quite got right into that luxury lifestyle. It had never really appealed to me all that much. But it was good to know that we could if we wanted to.
Right.
But
were you building towards something? Was there an end goal at that point that you thought would be the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
You know, Gareth, when you're building wealth, you think that there's a target, you think that there's an end goal, and it's the funny thing is, when you reach that goal, it's a plateau, and very quickly you think, what's next?
Hmm.
And it's the same in building a business.
Hmm.
You know, and with your business, with the radio, you haven't, I would imagine, you haven't set a limit on, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and then I'm just going to do this for the rest of my life. You'd be thinking, what else can we do? How else can we expand? It's human nature.
That's true. Hmm. That's true. But, I mean, from the point of view of your three girls, did you want to send them to a specific university, or was there any kind of plan for what you would like your retirement to be like one day?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Yes. With our girls, they were little at the time, and you know, when they started school, we did send them to the school of our choice, which was good. And in fact, when things went south, and I probably should get into how that happened, we did everything we could to keep them at school. So we went without our own home to keep them where we wanted them, because their future was important to us. And that is, in fact, what helped us to keep our marriage on track and our mental health and emotional health on track, because these three little people had done nothing wrong, and we needed to do whatever we could to preserve them through the experience, because they were going to, you know, they suffered through it.
So, okay, what was being done in business was that you were running this investment portfolio, and essentially it was a precursor to what eventually became known as a Ponzi scheme.
Well, we our own business was the real estate investments and some other investments and cash flow. The business of what this man was doing was he was trading currencies, and people would invest, mm-hmm. and he would trade with that and give them a return each month. And my role working for him was to pay them their return.
Okay.
And so that went really well for a year and a half, and then suddenly he stopped paying, and he said, look, the market's done this and there's no payment this month. I'm going to compound their interest. And it wasn't guaranteed. Nothing's guaranteed. Mm. So it wasn't unreasonable to say to people, look, it's been a bad month. There's no payment this month for us, me included. At the time, I had $104,000, which is, I believe,
a million. So what year was this,
roughly? This was 2005 is when things went wrong. Okay. So I had what would be the equivalent, I believe, of $1,440,000 rand.
Okay.
Yep. Now, if he had lost that legitimately trading, that we would have said a bit more than ouch, but we could have worn that because we could have absorbed that. And
could have sold some things. And
well, we wouldn't have even needed to, really. It came from our line of credit. We had six houses. We had things going on, and we would have just absorbed it and been, right. It was a high risk. It is what it is.
Okay.
Never occurred to me that he was a thief.
Right.
Never occurred to me. And, that was the first month, and it was my job to tell everyone we're not getting paid. Then it happened the second month, and people asked for their money back, and they got it, some of them. The ones who asked got their money back, so that was reassuring. But by the third month, I was the buffer. I was the person that people were asking, are we going to get paid? We need to get paid. You don't understand how much I need my money. I need to get my money. It's got to happen. It's got to happen. Then they weren't getting paid. And during that period of time, I became fully about the pressure of it, and I couldn't talk to my accountant because he had money in. I couldn't talk to my pastor because they had money in. I felt isolated.
You talked a lot of these people into doing this.
Well, I didn't really have to talk them into it. When people know that you're making money, they come to you and they want to know what you're doing.
It's like magnetism.
Yeah, I knew under the law I was not allowed to promote.
Okay.
So I never did, except that the definition by law is even by answering questions, it's considered promoting.
Hmm.
So I was careful not to go out looking for people, but they came to me.
And while all of this is going on, you're feeling all this immense pressure and you're absorbing all of it.
I am.
Where's this guy?
He was getting harder and harder to contact,
mm-hmm.
not returning phone calls, not returning emails, and I was starting to feel panicky. And feeling like the world was closing in and feeling isolated. And, you know, fear is a powerful thing. Fear and anxiety, they distort your perspective. And I'm in no way justifying what I'll tell you I did. I can't justify it, but I caved under pressure. And when some money came in, I said to him, do you think we could use this for now to pay people so that things are easier for you and it'll be all right next month? And he said, yep, do that. Now, I knew it was not the right way to do it.
But you were trying to help people.
I was, and I didn't steal it. But that money was not earmarked for them. It was supposed to go somewhere else, and I paid the investors with it. And that was a breach of the Corporations Act.
Oh, my God.
And, Gareth, I knew it was not the right thing to do. I just couldn't see an alternative. There would have been, I just couldn't see it. So I did, that's what I did, I paid people.
And that was where the problem
started. That was the illegal act that I did.
So that immediately changed your entire life, because then what was the first thing that happened after that that made you think, oh my God, I've made a terrible mistake?
Well, I made the transfers by email over the internet, and I think for about 15 minutes I felt some relief, and then I thought, oh my goodness, what have I done? You know when you've sent off that email and you wish you could jump through your computer and pull it back? It was a bit more serious than that. And within a few days, somebody complained to the authorities about this gentleman, and I was invited for an interview with the authorities, and I said, well, this is what's been going on that I'm aware of. This is what I did to try and fix it. Please tell me what to do so that I can get it put right, because I could have replaced that amount of money from my line of credit to get just to put it back, but I wasn't allowed to. And we were advised to go into voluntary liquidation. I still didn't know that the money had been stolen. I just thought he'd been having a tough time and the authorities froze everything. Yeah, and naive. You know, that's like I said, you think you're clever when you're successful, but there's always something that you need to be careful of and you need to learn more of and be prepared. Hard lessons to learn. And so they said, you did what? And I said, well, some money came and I paid people with it, and I can replace that now. So is that okay if I just do that? And it was a bit more serious. So I was advised to go into voluntary liquidation. And that was sold to me by the liquidators as, you know, we're here to help you get back on track. So we take over all of your finances and we sort you out and get you back on track. And I said, oh, thank you very much. What they do is pay themselves their hourly rate until there's nothing left. And that's what they did. They sold up all our properties and liquidated all of our assets and our home, and we had nothing left. And that was a process of 2 years. And during that time, obviously, you know, we were renting and we went back to work. And basically we went to work to pay two things. My priority was our girls' school fees and our lawyers. And that's what our life was.
Did you realize at that point how serious it was when the liquidators stepped in? Did you think, oh my God, this means I could end up criminally charged?
No. And the liquidators basically acted like they were helping.
Yeah.
Helping themselves.
They were.
And there was a point at the end of the liquidation. To be fair, the fellow in charge was quite nice. He sat me down and he said, look, you know, I've been through everything. Yes, you moved money where you shouldn't have, but I can see that you're not the villain here. But this guy is. You need to know he stole that money. It's gone. I said, no, it can't be gone. He said he's got it in the market and it's just frozen, and if the authorities would let him pull it out. And he said, Trish, it's gone. Look.
Where was he at this point?
Your blood
is pumping through your veins. You're thinking, oh my God, uncertain future.
I wasn't allowed to talk to him.
But did you find out post where he was?
Look, he was living at his address, and I didn't go over there. No. My husband was tempted.
Yeah.
You know, when I found out the money was actually stolen, I vomited for 3 days straight. It was the horror. I just couldn't comprehend that was the truth. You know, I had believed him and I had been loyal to him. You know, loyalty we think is a virtue, but if it's misplaced, it blinds you. And when there's a couple of things, you want something to be true and then you need to believe that it's true. And that's where a lot of people get caught up with, you know, with overseas scams where they think they're having a romance with someone whose mother is in hospital.
Yeah.
And can you just say that? They need to believe it because the alternative is just
sad.
too awful. And you know, it was just horrific, and obviously it was horrific for the investors, and so I carried my own guilt and loss, but I also felt responsible for the other people's losses, and I really had to do some work on my mind so that I would have gone mental if I'd carried that as well.
Absolutely.
And so he carried on. These things take a long time. The liquidation took a couple of years, and that was when I began writing my first book, and I didn't know what I was doing. I just needed to research and find out, how did I miss it?
Yeah, how did you get to this?
Yeah, I can pick it now, but back then, you know, I don't. And then the time came, I was served with papers charging me with fraud. And I'll tell you what, that's a far worse F word to me than the other one. And that was really frightening.
Did you immediately panic?
Yes. Yes, I just would just go, why?
What was the first thing you did when you saw those papers?
Well, I didn't really understand it. It was my first day on the job with a new job with a fellow I'd met at a breakfast, business breakfast, and he was actually an investigator giving a talk on fraud. And I said to him, oh, you know, I'm in a situation right now, and he felt sorry for me, and he actually hired me to promote him, you know, to say, don't do anything until you call this guy to get things checked out. I think it was more of a pity employment. And I got this letter, and I was shaking, and I even the person who delivered it to me, who's just someone who delivers these things, I said, no, you don't understand. And he's like, look, love, you know, just sign it, and I've got to go. So I gave it to my new boss, and he went, okay, Trish, this is what you do. You've got to change lawyers now. You're no longer corporate lawyers. You need criminal lawyers. He said, call these people. And he put me onto some lawyers. And it was good to have someone who was in the industry who could explain things to me. But I was just white and shaking.
Oh, my
and
God,
sick.
I'm sure.
It was like the Twilight Zone. And it dragged on for a year and a half. And nobody could tell me what my penalty might be. So I did research on comparative crimes, and the closest I could find, it was quite likely I would get a fine. I could have got a fine. But if you remember, 2008 was the global financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I fronted up to court in January 09.
Oh, my God. So they're looking for blood.
It seems. And so I was given the maximum.
Which is how many months in prison?
Well, the head sentence was 2.5 years, suspended after 8 months. So I had to serve 8 months in prison, and then I had conditions on being at home up until...
And you only found that out when the judge read it out?
Yes,
And who was in the court with you, your husband?
No, my parents were with me. My husband, we agreed that he would be at home, and he was just too overcome. And he didn't
trust
himself.
And someone had to look after the kids.
Someone had to look after the kids. So he was there, and he would take the phone call. But I actually, it's the little girl inside me, I guess. I preferred to have my dad and my mom with me. There was another friend that came along for moral support. I was in court for 2 days. And at the first day, it became apparent that there was going to be a sentence. And the judge said, if you can pay the money back, it will have an effect on your sentence, but I'm not going to say how much it is. So, like in America, I thought it would be like American TV, you know, like on Law and Order, where they say, okay, well, if you agree to this, you'll agree to a sentence of this or a penalty of this. No. So, I went home to discuss it with my parents, but we'd been cleaned out. At the time when I could have paid it back, I wasn't allowed to. And now he's asking, well, why haven't you paid it back? And we talked to my parents about whether they could pay. And I said to Mum and Dad, I said, look, no, if there's going to be a penalty, I don't want to come out of jail and then have to pay you back and have this big debt over our head. I said, I'd rather go to jail and come out more or less debt free. Because we didn't go bankrupt. When our assets were sold, our loans were all paid out. And the remains just went to the liquidators and not to the investors, because they weren't my creditors. It was a bit messy, but it was clear.
So in other words, you guys, you'd lost all of the tremendous assets that you'd built up over the years, but you had enough to live.
Well, we went back to work.
Yeah. But you,
and
but
so
you,
we were
you,
renting.
You weren't in the hole for a couple of million.
No. Okay. No. Well, we're pretty good with
and
money.
And you didn't want to do that with your parents, either.
No,
yeah.
No, because, you know, they were older, and I didn't want to do that to them. And, you know, my husband and I are pretty good with money. You know, we've done most – all our borrowings have all been about assets and, you know, good debt versus bad debt, et cetera.
Right.
What we did do that was my husband's initiative was that we moved in with my parents so that in the event that I went away, my mother would be there for our little girls and my dad would be there for him.
Right.
And he had a real estate job, a real estate business, and you can't look after three little girls on your own and go out signing contracts and things at all hours.
Absolutely.
So at the time, our little girls, Chelsea, our eldest was 10, and we have identical twin girls who were 7 at the time. Which is a really tough time to be without your mummy, you know, for the best part of a year.
How did you even tell them?
we told our eldest that I was going away. I said, you know how when you are speeding, you get a ticket and you've got to pay the fine, or when you're at school and you do something naughty, you get a detention. Well, I made a mistake and I've got a detention, and so I'm going to be away for a while. And it's the right, you know, when you do the wrong thing, this is what happened. And she did say, well, can we call them and tell them you're a nice lady? That was hard.
Sweetheart.
And I think now that she was probably too young to bear that. I don't normally get like this. When you're talking about my kids,
I
try to avoid that. And our little twins, we didn't tell them. We just said I was going away to help some ladies because I fully intended that I would keep my chin up and be an encouragement. So it wasn't quite a lie, but it kind of was. But what do you do?
Yeah, you don't want to tell them your mum is a fraudster and she's going to jail because the horrible judge has decided to follow through on a sentence rather than a fine.
But look, you know, Gareth, it might sound strange, but, you know, I made a mistake. I did the wrong thing and I got a penalty. It's not like I didn't do anything wrong. Mm. I know what I did. Mm. And so I thought, well, if this is the penalty, that's what I'll front up with. And look, I am a woman of faith. You know, my relationship with God is quite strong.
I was about to ask you, how did that test your relationship with God?
Absolutely. Well, the thing is, I'm not one of these people when something goes wrong, they blame God and run away, because they can't take responsibility. It was a case of, you know, I did pray, gee, Lord, you could have spoken a bit louder and warned me a bit harder. But, of course, I didn't want to listen. And in my quiet time, I felt like, in my prayer time, I just felt that the Lord was saying to me, you will go in, but I'll be with you, and it's going to be okay. Every time I prayed, I would constantly get, it's going to be okay. I don't know what, you know, God's version of okay and my version of okay are not necessarily the same.
So what was it like on the day that you had to wave goodbye and walk through the gate?
It actually was in the courtroom as soon as I was sentenced.
Oh, they take you straight away?
Straight away into a side door. I didn't even recognize that there was a door. It was a panel. It was like an invisible door in the wood paneling of the wall, and I had enough time to turn around. The way the judge had been talking the day before, he even told off the prosecution because they had said their recommendation, and he said, you should be asking for more. And we just went, oh, dear, this is not going well.
Oh.
But when my sentence... when I processed that it was first 2.5 years, suspended after 8 months, and it clicked in, okay, it's 8 months, it's less than a year, I turned around to my parents behind me and I said, it's okay, it's less than a year. I was more concerned with, you know, my mother's distress. And I got taken away, and it was just bizarre, surreal. And that's when handcuffs were put on, and I just remember thinking how I was surprised at how heavy they felt. And we went downstairs, and I was put in a cell for a while, and then I was transferred a couple of hours later to the Brisbane Roma Street Watch House, which is like a temp. It's where you go for a few days until they can collect enough of you to take you out to the prison, and that was pretty hideous.
Sounds awful.
That was just hideous. It was just hideous. I mean, I imagine South African prisons are much worse, just from my impression from the media and my readings and so on. But it was just like the characters that I met. I met this one girl. She was all dressed up. I thought she might have been a lawyer, except she had no shoes on. Mm. But she'd been dressed up for court as well, and she'd been in before, and she was quite nice. She was an alcoholic, and she'd been caught driving, so she was done. And she was able to tell me what the process that we were going to go through, which made it a bit easier. And we became friends, and we're still friends to this day. So we went through our sentences together, and she left earlier than me, and we stayed in touch, which was really lovely. But I met these characters, these wild characters, who I found fascinating.
They do segregate it on sex lines, so it's men and women are separate.
Yes, but in the watch house, I was there for... I went on Thursday and we left there on Tuesday. It's all glass. It's not bars. Mm. It's all this thick glass and everyone can see each other.
Mm.
And it's like a pod. It's like in a circular situation, and the officers are in an office
central
in the middle.
Thing,
yes.
Yeah.
So they can all see you, you know, and you're really just sitting around all day. There's not much to do. And I do remember if you needed to use the bathroom, everybody could see your head and shoulders. Like there was like a low wall.
Oh, right.
That came down so they can see your head and shoulders, and it sloped forward. And if you had long legs, they'd see your feet. And it was pretty creepy because I do remember there were men who would stand up on their chairs and chairs and tables were like a single frame bolted to the floor, and they would stand up on there and lean to try and see. And so we would stand for each other to block that view as best we could. And I just thought, that is just so creepy. Like, who does that? Who lives like that, that's a thing that you would do?
And when do you first get to connect with family or with your husband? When do you first hear from or see him again? Is it many days later?
Yes. Well, I had one phone call for 5 minutes where I talked to my family, and I warned my mom. I said to her, I know this is unfair, but you cannot fall apart in front of my girls. I said, if you go for a drive and go for a cry and a scream if you have to, but you've got to keep it together in front of them. I don't want them unnecessarily traumatized. And I talked to my husband about, you know, administrative things as well, because you have things that you've had to put in order, you know, for your affairs, which I had done, but just making sure a few things like that, which was also surreal. But to be able to visit, you have to download a form and fill it out and get checked and so on. And it can be 8 weeks before someone comes.
It's not worth doing it at that stage. You'd rather just wait until you're actually in the prison that you're meant to
Well,
be.
No one visits you in the watch house.
Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, that just doesn't happen. And I went, except maybe a chaplain, but we didn't see one of those either. We got out to the prison, and once again...
What clothes did you have? Did you go to court that day planning...
Dressed in my beautiful suit and my conservative blouse and trying to look as respectable as I could. One funny thing is that I had estimated the worst-case scenario, I might get a sentence of maybe 2 months. So I stupidly went and got my hair coloured, and that was blonde.
Uh-oh.
So if you see the back of my book, you can see my warrior princess pose with my blonde hair. So I thought, well, I'll get that, and I'll come out in time to get my roots done.
Uh-oh. That didn't happen.
I'll tell you what the real crime is, Gareth. It's 8 months of regrowth.
Do you laugh in prison? I mean, is there stuff to laugh at? Do you find a way to make it fun?
You know, the mad laughter of the damned. I think that's what it felt like.
All right, so how bad is it in there? Now you're in the actual jail, in the actual prison.
In the prison. How bad is it? Look, in some ways it wasn't as bad as I expected. I wasn't at risk of violence. There was some violence, but mainly that was between people who had issues on the outside or who had relationships and were fighting over jealous issues. But any hint of violence, people get carted off to S1, which is the punishment block. And so you're in general population with everybody.
You didn't have to go to S1 any time.
I did, actually.
Oh, you did?
I did.
What did you do?
I did. Well, I'm a bit embarrassed. First of all, you're in general population with everybody, and murderers, everybody, you're all in together until you get classified. And I was there for a good couple of months. It's supposed to take 2 weeks, but it takes a couple of months because, look, Gareth, it's not a customer service industry.
Sure, of course. Do people ask you, what are you in for?
Look, they do. And, I mean, the officers tell you when you go in, you don't have to tell anyone what you're in for, but it's the first thing they ask you.
Of course.
You know,
they need to know what they're up against.
And I felt the need to explain the whole story so that I didn't look bad.
Yeah, but you're among murderers.
And they say you're a fraudie. And eventually I was like, yeah, fraudie.
That's what they call you, huh?
Yeah, but yeah, the fraudies.
All right,
and there's a lot of frauds in there. A lot of them are single mothers who had boyfriends living with them and were collecting welfare. So if that amount that they've defrauded reaches a certain amount over time, then they get pinched. So nothing happens to the fella, though. Which is...
Doesn't seem fair, right?
Well, it's not. And it isn't fair because I did meet one lady in there, and this really broke my heart. She was an old-aged pensioner, grandma, respectable woman. Not a scruffy woman. She was respectable. And she was just in shock, and she could barely speak to anyone. And turns out that she and her husband were on a pension, and he had a little cash job on the side doing some gardening. Now, I don't know how it works here, but in Australia, you have to pay tax. And if you're on a pension, you're allowed to earn a certain amount of money in addition to your pension, but after that you have to declare it and your pension will be docked.
Mm.
It's fraud. But there's also a culture in my country that, you know, you hire a tradesman and 8 times out of 10 they'll say, which price do you want?
Oh, right.
You know.
Mm.
And,
in the books and not
yeah.
in the
and
books.
And that's no criticism of tradies. I think they're great blokes and gals. But it's kind of got that double standard of everybody does it mentality. Yeah. That's not to justify it. But look,
So this poor old lady was clapped in irons and thrown in jail.
Clapped in irons.
I mean, I'm dramatized. She was thrown in jail.
She would have been. She would
an
have
old been. Old lady who.
Yes, because she had benefited from her husband's criminal activity.
That doesn't seem at all right.
It's the law.
That's a terrible law.
Well, it's the law, and they knowingly broke it. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't care.
That's an awful law.
If some old man gets an extra $50 when he's
then take away an extra $50. Don't lock his wife in jail. That just doesn't
and
seem
you know,
sensible.
When they get home, when they had a, it was a 4-month sentence that they both got, and when she gets home, when she got home, she was going to have to, their pension would be docked until
forever.
Well, pretty much, until the amount they had defrauded. Now, look, he might have had a big thriving, you know, backhoe business. I don't know, but it didn't sound like it.
No.
He's
probably just an old man trying to keep busy.
Look, lots of people do things like that. And, you know, my heart just broke for her. And I did try to talk to her and comfort her, but she was just, she just put her hand up and like, no, I just can't. And what can I do? I tried. And my focus, you know, here's the thing. Whenever you go through an adversity, one of the keys I learned for preserving your mental and emotional health is any signs of self, like, yes, you have a little cry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did more than have a bit of a cry. I had a bit of a scream. But when you're in that situation, it's really important to step outside yourself and assess your situation and say, well, hold on, what have I got going in my life? And to look outward and just see how other people are doing life. And, you know, I got there and there would be women there who couldn't even read or write. There would be women there who were glad to be in prison because they're not getting belted up every day. There are people, I remember a drug addict saying to me, if I wasn't in here, I'd be dead.
God.
I saw one woman, she looked like a tractor had run over her arms. She was just addicted to self-harm. It was just demonic. And the spirit in the place, the atmosphere was so volatile. It's like each day it was different because we'd have different people coming in and going out. And there'd be around about 30 people in a block and the cells would be around the outside of a large area that had some chairs and tables. And then there'd be a door opening out to a caged area of concrete with a basketball hoop at one end and a telephone at the other end. And the caging was, I don't know if you have it here, but we have this square mesh about probably 3-4 inches square. And the sort of stuff they put into concrete.
Yeah.
To reinforce.
It's like scaffolding almost. I mean, reinforcing.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so the caged area was on 3 sides and above you, and then behind you was the building, so you could go out there. That was the general population. If you behaved well, you'd then go to residential, which had a little bit more freedom, and I didn't get there till much later on. I went straight from general population to another facility called Helena Jones Centre, which was a minimum security place where you got to wear your own clothes and there was no barbed wire and there were no dogs, no sniffer dogs. So it gave the illusion of like a boarding house. Mm. And that's where I allowed my children to visit me.
All right, but hang on. How come you ended up in S1? You still haven't got to that.
I haven't, yeah. Oh, you got to ask me the most embarrassing questions.
Come on.
They told me you were edgy.
Come on.
Okay, so look, I'm no angel. Like I'm just normal, like anyone else. And you know, I was at the resident. I was at Helena Jones, and I found it actually harder there than back at the prison because the illusion of normality and freedom that wasn't really there. The I'm not one that picks up on hints and unwritten rules and things like that. I just often miss those sort of cues, and I don't understand some of the strange rules that they have, and they don't make any sense to me, and I would question them.
All right.
And I was a bit of a pain in the neck, actually. And also, being a Christian, I made a decision not to hide that. Now, there were some in there who were so frightened they would hide it, because there are people who blame God for their situation and therefore they despise anybody who represents anything to do with faith.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also a rescuer, so I wasn't going to hide my faith, and that, you know, that caused some dynamics that were tricky, and I was prepared. Anybody who needed comfort and would like me to pray for them, I did. That actually got me in trouble back at the prison. Because
you got into trouble for praying for people.
Yep. Yeah, I did. funny, huh?
So is that what they sent you to S1 for?
No, I didn't. I went to S1 for something considerably less noble. There was a young lady who just was so annoying, incredibly annoying. She would eat other people's food, and she was just really...
I get annoyed with someone on a plane for 2 hours. I can imagine if you're living with them, yeah.
She had some issues, and because she was so annoying, she got away with a lot, like not bothering to get out of bed for the assembly, you know, when we had to be counted and things like that. And I think they had her there because she wasn't safe back at the main prison. She was that annoying. And look, I tried really hard. I really did. I tried all my strategies, and eventually, she just annoyed me so much that I it was really quite a bad thing that
I did. What did you do?
I let her hear me praying under my breath, not because I wanted to pray for her, but because I wanted to freak her out. And she said, "What are you doing?" And I said to her, "I'm praying for you." I nearly said her name then. I'll change it. I'm praying for you, Jane. And she said, "Well, don't." And I have another language that I sometimes pray in.
All right.
And so I let her hear me do that just quietly. And she ran out of the room and reported me to the officers. She was a tattletale as well.
So this got you into maximum security?
No, there's more.
Okay.
There's more.
All right, okay.
Well, I turned it into a funny story in my letter, and I made it. I got into the habit of writing letters to my family and friends that were quite entertaining, and I talk about different things that happened.
Sure, of course, you have to find ways to.
So I kind of described it in a way that, you know, that I got some perverse satisfaction poking someone's demons, you know, and you can take it as a metaphor or literal, however you want, but So my letter was intercepted.
Oh.
And I was, you know, brought into the office, and she said, "So you deliberately poked someone's demons and enjoyed it, did you?" And I said, "Oh, when you put it that way, it's really not a good thing to do." And I said, "Yeah." And they went, "Yeah, I think, you know, we don't need you here."
So they punished you.
They kicked me back to the prison.
Jeez.
But I don't think it was
you're
just
kidding
that.
Me.
I think there were a number of other
Come
things.
On.
I was a bit of a pain in the neck.
Oh, please. You sound like you this is the most inoffensive thing that could possibly have been done. It's ridiculous.
You know, it was one thing. Well, look, if you read the book, there'll be a string of things that were little incidences that got me in strife. And things like, in Australia, prisoners are called offenders.
Mm.
And I said to an officer, I said, why are we called offenders? Who am I offending now? Because this is a present tense thing. I said, I committed an offence and I'm being punished for it and I'm in prison, so I'm a prisoner. Why am I called? And she said, well, it's politically correct. And I said, how so? Please explain. How is it politically correct? I mean, I understand vertically challenged. I don't understand how being called an offender is going to rehabilitate me, because you're labelling me as continually offensive. And she said, well, I'll, look, I don't know, but why do you even need to – why do you ask these questions? So that was one. There was another time – there were a number of incidents. And
what did you do with all your time in there? You had 8 months and you only get a visit every couple of days.
Each week, yeah. Look, there were – at the minimum security at Helena Jones, we were allowed to catch the train. It was freaky catching the train. Oh my goodness. Stepping out of the gate the first time onto the footpath. I looked and I was waiting for someone to chase me down, but no, we stepped down onto the footpath. We were trusted to walk down to the train station, catch the train to the cemetery, and we would be there as cheap labour to weed the gardens and weed the graves that nobody tended to anymore. And that was actually quite nice. I would mow the grass and I learnt to whip. I never did master whipper snipping. I tend to put big divots in the grass, but it was so nice to be outside and not have a cage above our head. That was just beautiful. So that one. Oh, well, there was another time where they thought I'd escaped. That was
what?
Yeah, I know. I don't know. This one really wasn't my fault this time. You can't blame someone for misreading a map. So this cemetery was huge. Like, it was so big that it had roads in it that you could drive down. And he showed me the map and he said, "You're going to work here." And I went, yep, got it. And they were colour-coded, but what I missed was I thought it was the far corner, but there were some extra pencil marks that I didn't notice on the page. So I just kept going till we hit the corner where the roads met. And we were working there, and this was a section of the cemetery for the dead nuns from years ago, and they don't have families to tend to them. Nice morning, beautiful day. Morning tea time comes, and we're heading back for morning tea for Smoko down to the shed, and one of the officers, they check up on us from time to time. He's walking up the hill saying, and I said, "Oh, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Looking for you. Oh, and by the way, while we were weeding, there was a police car that zoomed past us because we were right on the corner."
It was looking for you as well.
Didn't know that, but we were weeding. You know,
but you were with other people.
One other girl. And this police car zoomed past, sirens blaring. And you know when you see a police car, you stop and you rubberneck, you know, you look and go, wonder what they're doing. You know. So we head down. We had been reported escaped, missing, because we were in the wrong spot and the guy couldn't find us. And he's obliged, this poor fella, he's not a prison officer. He's just someone who supervises, you know, he works for the cemetery and supervises, you know, these prisoners.
So you didn't get into trouble?
I got into big trouble.
You did?
Yeah. We're walking down and I mean, I probably wouldn't have got into much trouble if I hadn't laughed, which really didn't help. But we got down there to the shed, and this guy is going apoplectic. He said, "I told you where to go." And I said, "Look, give me the map." And I didn't see myself as a criminal, so I couldn't see what all the fuss was about.
Yeah.
And so he's just going off, and he's using language that they're not supposed to use with us. And especially not in a Catholic cemetery, goodness me. He'd told me what a good Catholic he was too, and I thought, well, you'll be going to confession, won't you? But I didn't say that out loud. I was smart enough not to do that.
But now, if you were clever and you were good, and you were both those things mostly.
Oh, I didn't say I was clever.
You got out after 8 months.
Well, they couldn't not let me out because that was a set time. I'm so glad I didn't have to apply for parole because I'm...
You would have been in more trouble.
Oh, no, I don't know. Well, I wasn't violent.
So as you approach that day, are you increasingly getting excited and or are you nervous because you know that there's a world waiting for you that you have to start patching together?
Yes. I was looking forward to it for a long time and it seemed to drag on. And as it got closer, I was apprehensive because I didn't know how people would respond to me when I came home. I didn't know whether I'd be able to get a job. I didn't know how mentally smashed I had become and emotionally, because when you're in the situation, it's like you hold your breath through the whole time. And then when you come home and you exhale, you just fall to pieces. So that was hard because, you know, and in that environment, I had been fairly straight and like they called me a 180 straighty for both reasons.
Sure.
But
you were ready to get out of there at that point and back. And how hard is it then to readjust?
It was harder than I expected. You think when you're in prison, you think the best day in here the worst day outside is still going to be better than the best day inside. You have this idealized idea of how it's going to be, that you're going to live happily ever after kind of thing. And what I hadn't counted on was I got home and I was just antsy, just kind of, I couldn't settle. Mm. I couldn't sit quietly. I couldn't settle. And then I would have nightmares. And I remember vividly having dreams that I was back in prison and not supposed to be. I was supposed to be out, but they wouldn't believe me. and they wouldn't let me out. And then another one where I had tried to escape and I was running through corridors and terrified that I'd get found, but knowing once I get out, eventually I'd have to get captured and they won't believe me. And I would wake up with my heart pounding and sweating and shaking and crying, and my husband would just hold me. Hmm. You know, other people don't have a husband to hold them. But
How did he handle the time you were in jail and afterwards?
It was very hard for him. He was quite shut down, my mother told me, but the focus was the children, and he was marvelous, and he would bring them to visit, and sometimes we stayed going to the same church, which was in Brisbane, and I've got to say, the church people were just brilliant, and the children's church
leaders... Not judgmental?
Not at all, not at all. We're not that kind of church. We're a very modern... free kind of, if you've heard of Hillsong, it's very, yeah, and very real, you know, very real. We get the brokenness. I'm not to say there wouldn't have been people there who might have been that way, but generally it's pretty good. But I've got to give credit, the people who looked after the children in the children's church and the head guy who did, they were so good. You know, he would take them there and he would drop them off and they would take care of them for us while he came to visit me, because I wanted to just have him there, just for that intimacy. And then he'd go and get them, and then he would take them further down to the Gold Coast for a treat, to go to Dream World or Sea World or one of those places, which was just another further hour south. So they would associate visiting me with a day out of having fun, which
was
good. Yep. Yeah, so it must have been hard.
But he's impossible.
He's marvellous. And when I came home, I knew I was messed up, and I did get counselling, and I saw a psychologist, and a lot of prayer, and a lot of time spent quietly just chewing things over. And, you know, I did take comfort in, you know, there's a verse that I believe the Lord gave me, which is Romans 8:28, which says that he makes all things work together for good for those who love him. And it doesn't say all things are good. It just says all the crappy stuff can be used for our good. And I started to look at, well, what can I do? Because the local supermarket didn't want me stacking their shelves. Not good enough. Couldn't be trusted for that.
You're an offender.
Yes, yeah, so offensive.
Yeah.
So I had to look at, well, what have I got to offer? I had some knowledge. I had some experience. And I had some strategies for coping mentally and emotionally and spiritually. And so I plucked up my courage. I spoke to a local the president of a local business group and shared my story, and she said, you have to come and speak to our group. And that was the start.
And how long after that before you decided you're not only going to write about your experiences, but you're going to go around and talk to people and help them to understand your own journey and what it could teach them?
Well, I had the green book that you have there was the one that I put on my computer before I went to prison. And I thought, how can I publish this without people finding out I went to prison? And I had to make the decision, well, I have to include it and I have to be open about it. And the funny thing is, the beautiful thing is, Gareth, when your failure is out there, I mean, it's on Google, nobody, you know, if anyone came to me and said, oh, you did this, and I'll just go, yes, so what? Yeah, it's there.
There's no power. Trish, and you know that's going to come up.
Yeah, but there's no power in it.
Yeah.
What can they do to me? It's like,
no,
yeah,
nothing.
And I paid for it.
Yeah.
You know, look, for
Absolutely.
A long time I continued to beat myself up, thinking it shouldn't have this and that. But and then I meet more people. Do you know, people tell me their failures now. They feel safe sharing with me their stories, and I'm able to put my arms around them and comfort them and say, you know what, it doesn't have to stay that way. You know, if you've done the wrong thing, you apologize or you pay the penalty and you move on, because everybody needs grace.
Do you have any regrets about the time after what you... Obviously, the biggest regret would have been moving that money.
Yes,
but
I do regret that. Yes.
All right, besides that, are there any regrets about the way that you conducted yourself, the things that happened to you, the things that you had and didn't have control of?
I could probably nitpick through them and think I could do a lot of things better, but I think when you're in a situation, you make the best decisions you can given the amount of love and fear that's in your life, that balance. You know, you do the best that you can at the time, and you try to be unselfish, and you focus on, I did find it helpful to focus on other people and to care about them. And I actually found the roughies a lot easier to get along with than the ones who were a bit higher up the pecking order.
In other words, in prison, it's almost a different social structure.
Look, it is. And with the roughies, you know where you stand with them. But it's the ones that you don't see it coming. Stabbed in the back, that sort of calculating. And it's like when people have been damaged at a young age, and many of these women had been sexually abused and had different things happen to them at a young age, it does affect your emotional maturity. So there's like a default of acting like we're in ninth grade at school.
Right.
That was hard. But regrets, I don't think, there probably are. I can't think of any now that if I look at it in context of, you know, I went through it the best way I could with the skills I had at the time. Now, knowing what I know now since then, if I had the development that I have now back in 2011, 2012, I would have recovered a lot faster. But I had to grow through that and learn that.
And how do you explain that stuff to your girls now? I mean, do they know the whole story? Are they up to date with what you went through? How it must have felt, what they were going through, what your husband was going through at the time?
Well, we had a number. You have these intermittent conversations. You don't kind of dump it all on as soon as you get home. And as they ask questions, I would try and give sensitive, age-appropriate answers. And it's only just recently that my eldest has read my book, because I thought it would be too upsetting for her to take that journey with me. The twins, you know, look, we had some behaviour issues. We had some emotional issues with them. I actually homeschooled my eldest for a year or 2 years just to rebuild that relationship. She was very angry, and we worked through that. And the twins, you know, one of them was very sensitive and sooky, and the other one was fighting at school, and so we had to deal. And the school was very good. It's a tiny Christian school, and the teachers knew, and so they were really considerate of them, which was really great. And just spending that time and having those conversations. There was one day, I think it was 2011, it might have been her age. She might have been about 11 or 12, and she was asking me about, you know, I wish this hadn't happened, Mum. And I said, well, darling, you know, at your school, somebody has probably got somebody touching them who's not supposed to be, in a way that they're not allowed to. At your school, there'll be somebody else, maybe one of your friends, their parents are divorced, and another one, their daddy doesn't live at home, and they're sad and they're lonely, and the grown-ups in their life are too busy to take time. And I said, and you are able to put your arm around them and say, I know how you feel, but it's going to get better, and you can be a friend to them. I said, if nothing ever happened to us, we would be useless to anyone else to give them some compassion. So I turned her thoughts to outward, away from self-pity, to what's the benefit in it, which is hard to do with little kids. You've got to keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so true, you know, this, what can I do with that that's going to be of benefit to someone else? And in doing so, you heal up that bit more in your own heart. Very, very important to control how you think about things. Vitally important. You've got to be really ruthless with self-pity.
You don't seem to have a lot of space for it.
Very little tolerance. Very little tolerance for. In fact, my daughter said the other day, she was upset about, she'd been disappointed, she'd missed out on something. She said, no one's allowed to be sad in this house. And it's like, and I thought, well, no, okay, back off a bit, Trish. Let her have her little cry, you know. She's like,
well, Trish, your book is out. People can read it. Any of the books, I suppose A Prison Journey is the one that I think a lot of people would be most interested in.
Sure, yeah. They're on Amazon. I don't think they're not in bookshops at the moment.
Okay. Amazon's good. We know Amazon. We can use that.
And they're in ebook form as well, so they're a little bit cheaper that way.
And well done. I think your story's inspiring. I really do.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well done for making it through.
Yeah, and now I get to be in different countries to share just encouragement with people.
Why don't you fly to New York? There's a guy called Bernie Madoff who'd like to talk to you, and maybe you can make him feel a bit better. God, can you imagine 150 years?
I'll make an appointment in 150 years' time. He can start giving motivational talks.
Well, thank you for telling your story.
Thank you for having me on.
This is CliffCentral.com.